whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Each and every night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts to give you something called a solution. The topics you want to hear, the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Robert Elder with us. He's the author of It Was Over When, Tales of Romantic Dead Ends. He's a journalist and an author whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Premier, Salon.com, and numerous other publications. From 2000 to 2009, he was a staff writer at the Chicago Tribune. He's the creator of It Was Over When and It Was Love When. Pulitzer Prize studs Terkel and calls Elder a journalist in the noblest tradition. Robert, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know what I think I should do? If I go out on a date, I should have the book with me and hand it to her before we go out and say, it was over when, so do you think we should even start?
Well, I think actually she would single you out. Like that would be, that you would make it over when, that's the problem.
Yeah, we get halfway through the date and I'd be good there. Now, let me ask you this. What triggered you, caused you to put this to pen?
Well, a couple things. One is, before this book, I had just finished a book called Last Words of the Executed, which is just as cheerful as it sounds. It was, an oral history of what people say before they're put to death. And so I told my wife, after this, it's nothing but, love and sex and frivolity from here on out. So I literally turned in the manuscript, and then the next day I founded these websites. It was overwhelm.com and it was lovewhen.com, and they just sort of exploded.
Now, by the way, when we talk about the love when, did you do a focus group? Did you talk to people, and did you get some kind of overarching themes, some common denominators, which give you the cues that it's over now? Because most people don't recognize it, and usually they're beyond that point, and they've really had a horrible time, wasted their time, and if they'd have known up front, maybe it would have been a lot different.
There was no focus group. It was a focus group of one, or two, actually, myself and my wife, who, by the way, hated the idea for It Was Over When. She thought it was petty stories about, the straw that broke the camel's back. But I actually think they're very human stories, and, it's about chemistry, and it's about finding not only about what you can live with, but also what you want. I think that's very, very important. And in terms of, just finding that right person, I mean, there are many more stories on It Was Love When than there are It Was Over When. I mean, the other way around. Many more over stories than love stories, which I think is true to form. I mean, you should strike out more times than you hit a home run.
Oh, sure. I have no question about it, because every time you strike out, you learn a little bit, you get stronger, you grow, and whoever you're going to see next or whatever you're going to do next, they're going to benefit by what you've learned out of the last one, if you're smart enough to do it. Now, when we take a look at these things, is there any one of these stories that really hit you as you were writing it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm basically the editor. People submit the stories to me, and then, I did do a little interviewing beforehand, but the thing that just hit me is just the commonalities, and we actually broke them into categories. So it's things like manners, that's a big one, sexual incompatibility is another one, family, and then just secret stuff you could never, ever sort of imagine. There are a lot of like common threads, and again, chemistry is just one of them. Chemistry is something, what could be, one person could be very, very attracted to it, and the other one can just be repulsed by it.
Let's go back and talk about manners for a moment, because I think that's critically important. We live in a very different culture than we lived in 15, 20, 25 years ago. And there's a story that I must have told 5,000 times, but it's true. Radio Susie and I were going to a business meeting in downtown Milwaukee, and we got to the building, parked the car, got to the building, and as we walked into the building, I opened the door for her. Susie walked in, and there was a woman probably 30, 34, 35 years old on the other side of the door. So I held the door open for her, and I waited for her to walk through. She stopped. She looked at me. She almost had tears in her eyes, and she says, you know, people just don't do that anymore. And she said, thank you. And I said, you're welcome. And manners are. We've got to this point now where if you're going to be independent, you can be independent all you want, but at the same time, manners still work. I'm speaking about on the women's side. Manners still work. A door still gets opened in the rest of it, because if you take that time to show the respect, it's got to break through.
Sure, and a lot of the stories are also, you know, like even table manners. My favorite one is, you know, it was over when we went to a nice restaurant and he blew his nose into a cloth napkin. You know, despicable, especially on a first date.
Yeah, there goes the first date. If I've ever had anybody do that to me, I would turn off. But I guess really the point is that we don't realize what we do, do we?
No, and actually that's one of the reasons I started the website. It's a place not just, again, to exchange funny stories, and not all of them are funny. Some of them are very heartbreaking. As you say, some people end up in relationships that are going nowhere and it lasts for years. But also it's a place for commiseration, and hopefully, you know, you see yourself in the stories that people are sharing.
Sure. And by the way, if you see yourself and you can recognize it, could it not save a relationship, save a job, save a something?
Well, I'm hoping so. And in fact, again, it was Love Win, which is the sequel, and that book is actually coming out in December. That is dedicated to my wife. You know, I think she came around on It Was Over When, but It Was Love Win. I really hope that each of these stories that end badly, they actually lead to a lasting love story.
Now, by the way, when you started to create this, it should be very interesting with the over when. Did you learn more about your wife? Did you get to know a side of her, or let's say a dimension of her that you weren't even aware of until all of this started coming out? Looking at other people, obviously, things that she felt, things she would never talk about, wouldn't even think about talking about until such time as she saw it in front of her.
Yeah. And sort of in a more general sense, I am the romantic in the relationship. I kind of always have been. But the more I saw what she was offended by or objected to or what touched her, it made me realize that she was a romantic. So that made me fall in love with her a little bit more.
Which is great. And by the way, I hope she listens to this so she hears that for validation. But when you really come down to it, we have to grow through others' experiences. We go through life and we have certain experiences. And if we don't have something that's beyond that experience to take a look at, you're never going to have the option or the choice to be or do something you wouldn't have thought of. It's not that you wouldn't have thought of it because you didn't have the time for it and didn't agree with it. You wouldn't have thought about it because you didn't know it existed.
Well, and that also made me want to ask you. I mean, I ask everybody their stories.
Sure.
You know, do you have a story where, and again, it's not a breakup story, but it's that internal moment when you realize things aren't just going to work out?
I got to go back and think about that for a moment. Realistically.
Well, and while you're thinking, I can tell you one of mine, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The one that I used to tell people to sort of get them started talking, I used to play this as a party game years before I started the websites. But I told the story, and I was curled up with a young lady that I had just started dating, and we were watching TV, and we were curled up in the same blanket, and she was eating a chocolate bar. And I sort of watched in horror as she took her chocolatey hand and just wiped it on the blanket that we were in, and then she folded over the corner. And I thought, this is not going to work out.
Okay, now, by the way, I'm usually very vulnerable on the air, so I hesitated not because I didn't want to open anything up, but I did remember something that that I'll never forget. I went out on a first date one night, and this had to be 30, 35 years ago, and we went to a club, and we were doing whatever, and there was a place where they had, you know, a band, and there was dancing, and the closer I got to her, the more she'd move away from me. We'd sit down in the booth. I'd put my arm in the back of the booth, and she'd move away from me. Everything she did was an indicator she was not wanting to get close to me. So I said, okay. So we got back to her place, and she lived upstairs in an apartment. And we walked up the stairs, and she started to take her key out to open the door. Now, I know I'm not going through the door, so this is a given, right? So I got the key from her, and I opened the door, and then she reached up to kiss me goodnight, and I started to, and then I backed off, and I said, I don't think so. And, you know, and I turned around, and I thought, gotcha, all right? I've got my real gotcha. And I started walking down the stairs, and about the last stair, right before the bottom, I tripped, and I'm laying on the floor because you could hear this crash, and all I heard was laughter as she closed the door and walked inside the house. But there was that, you know, it's not going to happen when somebody just won't get close to you.
And maybe it also wasn't about you. You know, her reaction could have been about, you know, the last person she dated as well.
Or she could have been coming out of a relationship, and she just wasn't ready to do so. Yeah, no, I didn't take it personally. It was just the trip and the bruises and the laugh that got to me. And I never again. No, but no, absolutely, I think you've got a very important point there. You know it's over when. Most people feel that they're responsible and they did something, or it was them that somebody, the reason somebody acts a certain way. And it's not so, because you can have somebody who absolutely dislikes you, and it has nothing to do with you. All they're doing is projecting, and it's about something with inside of them. And we don't know that. And Robert, because we don't know that, for the most part, a lot of problems start, and 55-60% of marriages don't work out.
And I mean, how much do you think of that is also chemical? I mean, one of the most popular sections of the website is chemistry, and you know, sort of second to that is also sexuality as well, just because of how we're built and what we're attracted to.
Okay, let me give you my take on that. What I've learned over the years: people who like themselves like other people who like themselves. People who don't like themselves like other people who don't like themselves. They have something in common. Somebody who doesn't like themselves doesn't like somebody who likes themselves, and vice versa. And I really believe when it comes down to chemistry and somebody doesn't like you, they either, if you like yourself, they don't like themselves, and they're not going to be able to act out the game with you, or vice versa. And I really believe when it comes down to chemistry, that spark, that something, some of it is killed by those who like themselves seeing somebody or going out with somebody who don't like themselves. You can feel that. And I think that's where it is. The chemistry, the click happens. If you get a couple of people who like themselves and it moves, or a couple of people who don't like themselves, the chemistry is going to be there because they've got a common bond.
That's interesting. I've actually never heard that before. That's a really, really interesting point. I mean, the sort of ancillary point that I've heard before that I've always found interesting, and I don't know if I agree with, is sometimes relationships, and very intense relationships, end because one person is more committed than the other. Like there's balance of passion or commitment, and that often will steer a relationship into the ground.
Okay, but they have to define what commitment is, and I think that's the problem in the very beginning. If you define what commitment is up front, then you know if somebody's off base. But if you walk in expecting somebody to be committed the way you're committed, and they don't understand from where you came from and how you define and how you work your way through life, I think it's going to be a major problem there.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. And, you know, it's funny, even as you and I, you know, sort of talk about this, I wonder how many people, you know, either see themselves or are at a point where they can see themselves, because I know when I was in a relationship, and even when I was in a relationship for too long, I don't know if I would recognize that through this conversation.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely, because we don't ask. And when I say we don't ask, this came up the other night, which I think is so. There was an interview that was done about, oh, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, somewhere in there. And it had to do, the name of the book was something like The First Kiss, It'll Make It or Break It. And the entire impetus behind the book was, we never ask, as men, we never ask how a woman would like to be kissed. We just take it for granted. We know, and they're supposed to think that we know how to do it. We don't know. And so wouldn't it be interesting if before you kiss somebody, you ask them how they would like to be kissed? That'll make it or break it. Now, I took it a step farther, because it made me think about it, and as time went by, for me, I turned it into this. You get into a relationship, and you ask them, how do you receive love? We don't do that, Robert, and a lot of that causes a lot of the problems that we have. I am not in a relationship now, but if I get into one, I will. That's the first question out of my mouth the moment we start to meet each other or be together, because if you don't know, you can't give it.
And are people, when you ask that, are they shocked? Or they don't? Do they even know how to respond?
I've never asked. I don't know. But the point is that if it's something to think about, and if they say, "Well, I really don't know," and if they don't know how to receive love, then you both get to do what? You get to find out together. So it's not hidden anymore. Just because I'm a guy doesn't mean I know what a woman's going to expect physically, emotionally, intellectually, monetarily. You got to ask.
That's why I asked for a graph chart. I just asked for like a worksheet now.
You know, that's interesting. Wait a minute, you're going to go out with somebody and what you do is you fill this out and let's see if we can do this or not. And it's almost not a joke. There should be classes on how to go out, how to meet somebody to make sure that you're not going to fall down on the way to the journey that you're both taking.
Mm-hmm. Or you're going to fall down on the last step.
There you go.
That's the other thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I mean, we joke about like this thing, but actually one of the stories in the book is she told me that I met 36 of 38 criteria. And I thought she was laughing until she showed me the checklist. And that made him give up.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I hear you loud and clear. Now, Robert, we're starting to run out of time. I'm running out of town after that one. Running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, yes. Actually, two websites. itwasoverwhen.com. And again, we are still collecting stories for sequels to the book that's out now, It Was Over When, Tales of Romantic Dead Ends, and then It Was Love When, and again, that book comes out in December, so itwaslovewhen.com and itwasoverwhen.com.
One more quick story, because this one has got to be told. This is before the days of cell phones and car phones and the rest of it. I went out on a blind date one night. And we had the greatest time together, and we really connected. And we finished up, and I was going to take her babysitter home, and she said, "Why don't you come back?" And I said, "Great." And so I took her babysitter home. I couldn't find the directions back to her place, and I spent an hour roaring up and down the streets at 100 miles an hour and never found my way back. You know it's over when you don't have the directions to get back.
Well, that's great, and that's tragic, and I really hope you submit that story to the website. I'd love to have that on the website.
I promise you I will. Robert, hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Berger with us. She's the author of The Five Ways That We Grieve, Finding Your Personal Path to Healing After the Loss of a Loved One. She's founded the Center for Loss, Bereavement, and Healing in Framingham, Massachusetts, where she is a clinical practice. She offers workshops to professionals and hospices as well as general audiences. She served as a hospice volunteer working with the dying and bereaved families. She earned her doctorate in education with Harvard University, as well as a master's degree in social work and a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Boston University. She also holds a certificate of thanatology from Mount Ida College. And let us say, Susan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael Ray. It's nice to be here.
I always have problems with that word, thanatology. Is that it?
Thanatology is the study of death, dying, and bereavement, and it emanates from a Greek root of the word.
Yeah, it's just I've gotten into it before. I have the worst time saying that word. If you ask
me, it's a tongue twister.
If I do it five times, I'm in trouble. Now, by the way, I really believe in my heart of hearts that grieving is, you know, it's a process that people go through. It's not just something we hear about. It's an emotional, it's a physical, it's an intellectual process. But we grieve in very different ways. You and I may have the loss of someone, and you'll grieve in one way. I may grieve in another way. And you might not even know that I'm grieving and think, look at him, he doesn't care. So I think going into the types of grieving that people can truly get a handle on and say, this is grief. I can't work on anything unless I know what it is and how it manifests.
Sounds right. Absolutely. Grieving is a very individualized process. We all experience it differently, both emotionally and physically, as you say, also spiritually.
Sure.
And it has a lot to do with the relationship that you have with the loved one that you lost. That's a key factor in how people grieve.
Now, by the way, in all of your experience, what was it that triggered you to realize that not necessarily even the types, but the stages of grief, because it's going to move through different stages. And if we understand the stages, then we also understand that we're either closer or we've got a way to go before we, if it ever really finishes up.
Well, it's a really good point. I wrote this book. I wrote it because the five stages of grief were really about helping to understand the dying and how they went from a process of denial to acceptance of their own dying. And I got very frustrated by the fact that survivors go on. We are the ones that have to figure out how to live without our loved one and to rearrange our lives and to readjust in ways that hopefully will allow us to grow from our experience and also to help others who have been grieving.
I think what you get stuck with, what you get left with somebody who you're close to dies, whether it be a parent, a loved one, or somebody, is what you didn't complete with them in life. And most people do that. As soon as somebody dies, the first thing that comes up is the coulda, woulda, and shoulda. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that if you're in a relationship with somebody, and that relationship doesn't have to be man, woman, it could be with your parents, with your kids, somebody. If you're in a relationship with someone, that get it out before it's too late, because once it's over, you can get it out, and there is a way to get it out, because if you can get it out of you, it's all right. But if you don't connect that disconnect, it's going to carry on in every other relationship that you have.
You're absolutely right that people should communicate those things beforehand. However, Michael Ray, I have to point out to you that unfortunately, not everyone has the luxury of being able to say those things before their loved one dies. For example, if there is an accident, or
sure,
someone drops dead of a heart attack, or there's some kind of violence, even such as happened on 9/11, where people left things unsaid because they didn't really anticipate that they wouldn't have a chance to talk about these things. And what happens is that for those people who have unresolved issues or words and ideas they didn't say, they often develop what we call complicated grief, which is a deeper form of grieving and can lead to depression, which really needs to have some professional help.
Sure. Okay, but let me put it this way. Somebody listens to us talking tonight. Then go find who you love and tell them.
Oh, absolutely. I know, listening to your program, that you are a major proponent of good communication. Ask people what they want. Tell them what you want them to know. Those kinds of things are important in all human relationships. You're absolutely right. But when we're confronted with death and dying, you know, people often are afraid. They're in denial themselves. They don't want to face the reality, or they are afraid for the person that they're speaking to sometimes.
You know, I go through life and I feel very, very lucky. Well, my mom passed away in 1993. She was 83 years old at the time. And I can say to this day, there was nothing incomplete in our relationship. My mom was my hero. I mean, there were so many things she brought me up to be, however that I am. And the key was, of course, I didn't want to see her go, and I miss her till to this day. I'll talk to her. But there was nothing left unsaid. And that's so critical, and I feel so lucky to have that.
Well, let me suggest to you that if people cannot communicate verbally, that the five ways we grieve, as I have described them in my book, are other ways to honor and pay tribute to loved ones who may have passed away before these things were able to be said. So, for example, I identify the memorialists, the normalizers, the activists, and the seekers. Four different paths that people whom I interviewed and whom I've observed over the years have chosen as ways to help their honor their loved ones and keep their memory alive, keep their connection to their loved one, but also to create greater meaning and purpose for their own lives.
A loving legacy.
A loving legacy. May I just walk through very briefly each of those means?
Absolutely.
The memorialist are the people who are likely to create concrete objects or lasting memorials, people who will write a song, who will write poems to their loved ones, who establish funds for scholarships to honor their loved ones, all in the name of keeping their memory alive. The normalizers are manifesting their love for their loved one in a different way. Normalizers want to replicate the kind of life they had with their loved one. So, for example, if they were married and they were happily married, they are likely to choose marriage again, a second time. There are also normalizers who didn't have the kind of life that they wished they'd had with their loved ones, sometimes in cases where a child's parent passes away before they have a chance to grow to adulthood. And in one story that I tell, a man actually creates the kind of family life that he missed when his own father died. Those are the normalizers. Activists, as you might imagine, are people who get involved in the causes that were associated with the loss of their loved one. I have a client whose father died of a brain tumor. He spent months in a hospice, and now she and her family go back and volunteer. And they run on the fundraising walks, and they're activists to help that cause. Seekers are people who choose to look at life through the lens of spirituality, or to really start thinking about what the meaning of life is and where they fit into the world, especially after now that they've lost their loved one. So those are four different paths that people take, all of which help those who have lost loved ones to stay connected, to remember them, to honor them, even if, as you say, they didn't have a chance to fully do so while their loved one was alive.
Sure. There's one more in there. There's one more. I was listening very closely to you. There's one more, and that one more is to be the absolute best you can be to memorialize them.
As a person.
As a person, as being successful, as doing something to memorialize them, because they do live through you.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I felt was really important to say there is that when you lose someone, your identity changes. It can inspire you to be a better person, to take more action, to contribute more to the world, all in the name of the person that you loved.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree with you.
What a wonderful gift.
I think it's a wonderful gift. I would like more people to understand that this is not what the five stages of a grief are about. We have to get well beyond the level of acceptance and deal with that emotionally toward living a new life, living a changed life, and becoming a different and hopefully a better person.
Let me tell you what I would love to see, Susan Berger. I would love to see this. There, you know, we have so many divorces today, 55-60% in the first year, etc. We don't have to belabor it. Most people know what the statistics are. People have a hard time relating because the culture changes so drastically. But what I would love to see, if somebody's going to get married, they should have a class on getting married. If they're going to have a kid, a class on having a kid. And most important, if they get married, the class on getting married should also have the class on grief. Because if you know ahead of time, these are things that it's just too bad that most people have to find out. And you said it, I don't know how many times so far, after it's too late. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you could know what to do ahead of time, just as an indicator? You don't have to walk into some place and say, okay, we're going to die, I don't want to see it. But what happens if? What's going to happen to that other person? If I am in a relationship and I truly love someone, I wouldn't want them to I wouldn't want to see them go through some horrific emotional problem because I wasn't there anymore. So wouldn't it be a great gift to be able to work your way through before it even happens?
I think that's absolutely right. And really, I also speak to groups of people who are divorced. And what we talk about are the ways in which divorce changes people and changes their lives. Everything from, you know, the emotional loss that they have to experience to the readjustment of perhaps taking care of children, adjusting their finances, making new friends and losing others. There are a whole lot of ways in which those kinds of relationships are also affected and have to be grieved. You're right. I don't think using the word grief is as effective when you talk about loss. I think people can identify with that more.
No question. Yeah, no question. But you know, from the culture that I came up, that I was brought up with, we don't grieve. John Wayne wouldn't grieve. I don't grieve. But you still.
That's right. That's right. Unfortunately, and the other thing about American culture is that we don't really allow people to grieve for as long as they need to. We expect them to take a week or 3 days of bereavement leave and come back and be the same old person. And it's, you know, not only unrealistic, it's in some ways uncompassionate or, you know, lacking in understanding of what a person who has lost someone significant in their lives has to go through in order to return to some form of normalcy.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it, because basically, if you can't deal with it, and if you don't have anybody to help you deal with it, and I truly believe that most people cannot do it by themselves, you've got to have that person with that expertise that you do not have to help you look at your life, to see things that you don't see. Every one of us are like that. There's pieces and parts of your life that you don't see. So somebody else needs to come in and say, well, look at it this way. There's pieces and parts of my life I don't see. So, I mean, even from working with a computer to being a romance to something, there's always somebody that if you allow them to use their expertise, you allow them to bring the invisible and put it up on the table so you can see it. Because until you see it, Susan, you can't work with it.
You can't change. Absolutely. No one can change if they don't know where they need to. So you're right. That perspective that can be offered by a professional is invaluable for people, especially when they're going through a crisis such as this.
No, absolutely. Susan, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you and the book at?
Thank you. It is www.dr, that's just D-R, Susan Berger.
That's it?
That's it, .com.
And I love every second of it, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us. And most people should get this book. I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you, Michael Ray. Take
Good
care.
Night.
Bye-bye.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return,
Julia asked me with us. She's the author of If I Were Your Daddy, This Is What You'd Learn. She's a rocket scientist, literally a business executive, a classical painter, and a researcher into conscious parenting. Her critically acclaimed book, again, If I Were Your Daddy, This Is What I'd Learn. She also represents the Global Parenting Coalition Program. And let's say, Julia, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael Ray, for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we say the word, the term daddy, just because someone is a father and biologically they are able to produce a child doesn't mean that they're a parent. And I think there is a bridge between being able to produce and being able to become that person that your child models after. And let me start all the way back in the beginning. Julia, what was it that triggered you to decide to put this to pen to create what you did?
Well, you know, great question, because people look at this and they say, a book on, is it for fathers? You know, If I Were Your Daddy. And really it came from me being a single mother for about 7 years of my son's life when he was really young. And I was taking him to the park one day, and I looked down and I realized at that moment that it was up to me to be mother and father. I mean, it really struck me, and I thought, I have no idea how to be a father. I mean, what does that look like? You know, what do you do? How do you, I was just barely being a mother at that point. He was quite young, and I was working and taking, you know, as a single mother, you're doing everything. So I started, you know, reading a lot about everything I could. And I read lots of great parenting books, but they told me all the things I should be doing, that I must be doing. And it really added to my overwhelm, Michael. It was as if there was just even more to do than I already was, and nothing really helped. And it wasn't until that I relied on my background. As you mentioned, I'm a NASA researcher, retired NASA researcher, and I said, you know, I can start asking these great fathers, and, you know, what are they doing? What are they teaching their kids? I kind of wanted the shortcut version. I wanted stories. I had to have stories. I looked for, like, the chicken soup for the soul kind of story,
yes,
but one that would teach me great parenting, great fathering, great mothering. And that's what I did.
You know, it's interesting because if you think of the word science, if you define science, if you go to the dictionary, what you're going to find is something that is provable. You being a researcher, you get into processes,
yes,
provable processes. And that's
yes,
the same thing that you have to do to be a mom or to be a dad. interesting, to back up what you were talking about, my sister and I, we were brought up without a father. And if you could sit the both of us down individually and say, describe your mother, you would get two completely different women.
Wow.
I was a boy. I mean, I did things that my sister didn't do. She was a girl. Girls did certain things in those days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what does that tell you about your mom? I mean, you think she had to be mom of dad, right? So she had to do it
absolutely.
All?
You bet. She had to be mom. She had to be dad. And we were raised totally without a male influence. And she really, when my dad passed away in 1950, when my dad passed away, she had never remarried. As a matter of fact, I think she only went out one time for the rest of her life. So she raised four of us. And she was mom and she was dad. I remember I got in trouble in school and I walked out and I got home at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I was a scrappy kid. And she said, what happened? And I told her and she grabbed me by the back of the shirt and she was only 5 foot tall and marched me right back. She was mom and she was dad. Absolutely.
Well, you know, Michael, the statistics now, the 2009 census say that 33% of the children in America are growing up without their father in the home. It's 33%. And then here's some statistics that when I, in my research, found this out, it really added like rocket fuel to my research. And it's this. From single-parent families, 63% of all youth suicides come from single-parent families.
Oh,
71%
sure.
of all chemical addictions come from single-parent families. And 80%, now this is just makes my hair stand up, 80% of prison inmates come from single-parent families.
Absolutely.
It's really important that, as you, your mom did, and I know you guys raised them, lots of kids are growing up fine. It's really important that mothers, you know, really understand these statistics and what they can do about it. And that's why around Mother's Day, I'm talking a lot about what single moms can do.
See, but Julia, my mom did not have what mothers have today up against them. We are talking in the 50s now, all right?
Yeah.
So we're talking about a world where... I don't remember anybody doing drugs in school. I don't remember.
Yeah.
There was one girl in the entire school who got pregnant. They whisked her away, and that was the end of that. Did people have guns? No. So there weren't the problems that we have today. One of the major problems that I have found over the years, excuse me, is that we search for one thing and one thing only. We search for acceptance. We search for identity. And we search for the one thing and one thing only, family, to accept us and that we can identify with. If you do not get it at home, you're going to get it outside. And some of the places outside are not the best places in the world.
That's exactly right. If you look at when children's behavior, when it goes awry, I mean, underneath it all, there is some basic need that is crying to be met. And so, you know, if you look past the issue of bullying, which is very big this week, tragedies happening all across the country,
sure.
youth suicides and from bullying, if you look underneath it all, there's both parties, there's a need, there's something that's not being met, and if they don't get it at home, where are they going to get it?
Outside, you bet. Outside.
Yeah.
And you
exactly.
can't control it from the outside. I remember there was the days where there was a friend of mine, were standing in his backyard, I must have been about 12, 13 years old, and he was standing on the roof of his garage, and I called him something. He said, you do it again, I'm going to throw this at you, and he had a golf club in his hand. And he threw the golf club at me after I called him again. He hit me in the head and was bleeding. And I went home and my mom opened the door and I'm standing there in a pool of blood. She says, get in here. She washed it off and cleaned up and I went back out and I played again. See, that was dad, you know, suck it up, man up, take care of yourself and go back out there again. So she was mom and dad.
Yeah. And our roles as fathers have changed. I mean, you bring
sure.
up, The kind of fathers that your mom had to be back then that was acceptable, that was normal, the kind of fathers that when you had a father present is much different than the fathers that are here today.
Oh,
that,
sure.
that want to be active. The dads at our home survey shows, statistics shows that they want to be more active, and 51% of a survey from the National Fatherhood Initiative said that they feel inadequate to be a father and they feel like they could be easily replaced.
No, by the way,
what's that?
Go ahead.
I was saying this is it's a tragedy. I mean, this is like, I want to shout it from the rooftops. You look at the statistics of the inmates and the suicides going on. It's like children need that fathering influence. And when you're a single mom, like your mother was, like I was, like many hundreds of millions, you know, are, you have to figure out what dads do and then, you know, replace it as best you can. And I say, as I say throughout the entire book, is that to bring in other role models. You can't do it alone. Did your mom bring in, did you have an uncle, people from church or anything to help you form the values?
Yeah, Julie, it was all her.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, no, she brought us, and she was not a tough woman. She was, you know, and she worked, she was a waitress. She worked at the local, the soda, whatever it was at the drugstore, and more kids knew her than they knew me. So, you know, she didn't, you know, and if she made $2-3 worth of tips every day, it was fine. But those were the days she bought a house. The house was $10,000, 50 bucks a month. And she raised all of us. We all, when it was time to go to school, we all had new clothes to go to school with. And we sat down to dinner every night. And on Sunday nights, we were all together no matter what. But see, here was the difference. I sat down with a guy about, oh, a couple of years back, and we talked, and he was brought up in a very rough neighborhood in the middle of the, in New York. There was a Bronx or somewhere like that. And there were gangs, and he was Puerto Rican descent. And he was all part of that. And his dad had been an alcoholic, never really got home, never gave any money into the house. Half the time they went hungry. There was rats, and, you know, the story goes on. And then he said if he'd walk out in the street and somebody'd look at him from across the street, the fight would start. And I asked him a very simple question. And the question was, is when you hit that kid, who were you hitting? And he stopped and he said, my dad. And I think that's where the problem is. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's you know, and as you pointed out earlier, it's just getting even more serious in terms of the challenges that children have today.
Yeah.
And the parents have and the stresses. And that's so why it's even more important that parents, I say great parenting actually makes it easier. And that's what I was looking for. I was looking for not just another parenting book. I wanted stories of how great fathers, great parents were doing it. Tell me your story. Tell me your story just like you told me there, that I can learn from something. I mean, and that's how we both learn. I mean, it's the oldest way to learn is to learn through a story. So that's why I gathered 35 stories. And now when my son comes to me and there's a challenge, and there's always challenges as a parent, there's always storms, and we just have to learn to surf above them, you know, ride the waves, then I've got 35 voices in my head helping me to decide what the best way to handle this current situation is.
Oh, sure. I mean, absolutely no question about it. And you said to the operative word, you used the L word, learned. Parenting is a learned skill, and parenting is also a strategy. And if you think you're just going to be a parent, that doesn't work.
Right. It's much better when you've got options. Now, another thing that I'm really strong, because I do lecture all over the country, is that I say, you know, I don't want to tell a parent how they should parent, but I do want to give them a lot of options so that they can choose the best one. Because if you don't know anything different, you will do what your parents did for you, if you liked it or you don't, because it's the only model you know. And when the moment comes where you're pressed upon to do something, you'll respond, boom, just like your parents did, unless you've got something better to take its place. John Gray said in the book, I interviewed him, he's the author of Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus.
Sure.
And I interviewed him, and he said to me, Julia, I realized very early in my parenting that it wasn't good enough to know what I didn't want. I needed something better to take its place. And that's what he spent, you know, a lifetime figuring out.
No, absolutely. And the key is, if you get it figured out, and the child knows that there are consequences for their actions. And I don't mean beat a kid up. That's not where I'm at all. But there are consequences for when you do the wrong thing. Why do they stop and look both ways on the street before they walk out? Because there's a consequence if you just run out into the street. This came up on the air, I think it was last night, and I'll do this rapidly, but if you go all the way back to the frontier, you know, mom and dad were the be-all, end-all, because that's where the kids learned their skills to survive. They learned to shoot, they learned to ride, they learned to do whatever from the father. From the mom, it was to cook, to do this, and so on and so forth. Well, as modern technology grew and as the trains were created, they started moving farther away from home. And as they moved farther away from home, mom and dad were now not the gatekeeper. They weren't the be-all, end-all. They went to school. The government did this and did that and whatever. So realistically, those kids today do not look to the parents. They don't look to the parents for the guidance that they should be getting. They've been taught to get it somewhere else. And I think that in and of itself is a major problem.
I think as parents, you've got to pull that back. And, you know, if you're listening here, that's what you don't want. You don't want them to learn their values from, you know, YouTube and the television. And it's really simple as, you know, it can be really simple. Let me put it that way. It's simple but not easy. And you spoke about a core message that runs throughout all these 35 dads that I interviewed, which was natural consequences. Several of them said to me, look, your children would rather be punished by you than have to clean up the mess that they created. One father, president of a major company, said that his daughter was caught, you know, toilet papering, you know, decorating a house, right, with a bunch of other girls, right? Yeah. She got caught. They all got caught. He made her, he didn't lecture her, he didn't wasn't upset, he just says, you will go back and apologize to the homeowner and clean it up. Now, surprisingly enough, many of the girls did not have to go and do that. She was one of just a few. And, you know, did she ever do this again? No, because she had to face up to it and clean it up. Another kid stole a camera again. He had to go and face it up to it and apologize and return the camera. And, you know, nothing like that ever happened. That's, if you let them suffer the natural consequences, it teaches far better than you shouting, yelling, punishing, grounding.
Well, by the way, that happened to me when I stole something from the local market. Now watch, they're going to be beating the doors down to get me. But I stole something from the local market, and my mom found out, and she made me work. I mowed lawns and things to get the money back, and I walked in there, and I had to tell them and pay them back.
Yeah.
Consequence.
Yeah. And did you do it again after that?
You bet I didn't.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we want to make things easier for our kids, but, you know, the best thing is to let them learn for themselves. One of the stories I love that Terry Tillman, who's just an international speaker, is an amazing man. He told me the story, and it's one of my favorites from the book, and it's this. It's that his daughter calls him close to midnight, right around when she's supposed to be in. She's about, you know, 15. Calls and says, Dad, I'm at jail. And he's like, what? And he's like, yeah, we were picked up for drinking. You know, can you come pick me up? You know, so, I mean, this is like a nightmare for a parent, right? So you're driving down there. He took his time to get there. You know, he figured it out what she needed to do. The judge, the sheriff let her go, and he has to go see the judge tomorrow. And she says, Dad, what's going to happen? You know, she's scared at this point. And he's calm. He doesn't yell, lecture, anything. He says, honey, you're going to have to come back tomorrow, but, you know, I'm going to take you somewhere. And he took her over to the county drunk tank. And he walked her in the drunk tank where there's barf on the floor and it stinks and they're yelling. You know, they're saying lewd comments to her. And he looks at her and says, honey, if you keep making these choices, this is where you might end up. Is that what you want? And she said, you know, of course, no. And he said, I didn't have to punish her or lecture her that because I never had any trouble with alcohol or drugs because here's the natural consequence. He took her to an end point of what the natural consequences could be so she could see it. And, of course, you have your own sense. You don't want that. So that, to me, was so effective. If we can find ways to do that so we can help our children, you know, find out how things might end up if they just think about their decisions over here when they're still small. And, you know, Michael, that's just one of my favorite stories, and I've used it time and time again in different ways.
Now, by the way, we're running out of time, but this is a quick story, and it has to do with that. It was one of the – now, I'm going to tell you the story, but you got to promise not to tell anybody that I told you.
Okay.
Okay, good. All right, here's the story. 1971, I met a woman that I really liked, and I ended up marrying her down the road. And so it was in the courtship part of it. So we're out doing something, and I was at home, and she was with me, and my sister called. And she said, you got a mom's in jail. You got to go bail her out. I said, what? Yeah, they got her for shoplifting. What had actually happened was she was in the market like she always does. She got something and she stuck in her purse instead of putting it, because it was small, instead of putting it in the shopping cart. And I guess security saw her and they busted her and they called the cops and they took her to jail. Well, we went over there and we got her and she got out of there and she was, you know, yelling in a very quiet way. But everybody gets to learn their lesson. She never put anything in her purse again in the market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I won't forget it, and neither will she.
See, that's, you know, what makes a difference in, is, you know, these high-impact events like this. So if you can create a high-impact event, something that's rememberable,
sure,
you know, and like that, then, you know, you don't have to tell them twice.
Yeah, and by the way, she never lived it down, but we didn't say too much.
Right. Well, I'd love to give your listeners a sample of the book. I have 3 free chapters on my website where you can go to and download it and read it and see what you think about it. Can I give you the website?
Oh, please, yes.
Okay, it's www.ifiwereyourdaddy.com. And at the bottom of the menu or the bottom bar, you'll see try it. And there's your 3 free chapters. So ifiwereyourdaddy.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking to you. What a thrill. Thanks so much for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Okay. Bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Is that a yes? Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back. I used to say 5 good minutes with Dr. Einstein. Einstein, he knows everything.
a distant relative, the smart
did
one.
Did you love that? Wait, but did you love that, Mayor?
I love it.
Dr. Einstein, yes, he knows everything. By the way, hey, thanks for coming back. We need to talk health here.
I'm more than happy to. You know, I'm very excited because, you know, 2 things. So first of all, there was a study that was released a couple days ago, something that Michael, you and I have been talking about for a few years, and that is low vitamin D levels linked to diabetes risk. You know, this was a study that was done. They followed more than 5,000 people for more than 5 years, and they found that the lower your vitamin D level was, the higher your probability of developing diabetes. Now, you know, I think that's one of these things where you may be looking at the wrong factors, but there's no question about it that there is a correlation between low vitamin D level and, we're talking about adult onset
sure.
diabetes, you know. But you know, and at the end still, so they go through this whole study, and then at the end they say, well, we're not sure. Maybe people have to be taking more vitamin D. Now, what's wrong with them? You know, here they come up with this fabulous study, you know, and they start saying, well, we get enough in our food. It's like they didn't even do their research, except they know that their vitamin D is too low. Don't they realize there is no food that has vitamin D because the fish are contaminated, and that's the major source of vitamin D, and we're not allowed to be in the sun because obviously the sun, God put it there by mistake. I mean, at least that's what the skin doctors think.
Yeah, really. Now, Mayor, you and I have been talking about vitamin D3 for about 100 years now, you know, for a lot of years on the air, and what I've noticed in the last couple of years, I'm starting to see more ads. There are more people
exactly.
getting...
Exactly. Well, I can tell you something very sinister that you're not going to want to hear. You know, the American the Institute of Medicine just came out with a report saying that they think that even a level of 20 is sufficient, and we know that the level's got to be at least 60 to 80. That's what all the major scientists say, and they didn't consult any of the leading scientists, Dr. Garland, Dr. Heaney, Dr. Connell. Doctors have been doing work for 30 years. Doctors have no vested interest in this. And who did they consult? A doctor called Dr. Lucia. Now, who's Dr. Lucia? You go look him up, you find out. He's applied for multiple patents for chemically altering vitamin D and getting a patent on it. And so it'll be by prescription only, and you could be guaranteed when they get their patents for this, the pharmaceutical industry, all of a sudden they're going to want the levels to be 60 or 80.
Oh, sure. Once they get the patent, and we're talking about in the almighty dollar again. I mean, business is, you have to make money when you're in business. There's no question about that.
Right. I'm a capitalist. Oh, I believe in that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But what you need government scrutiny is the pharmaceutical industry having their ties into big farm into the government, where they don't necessarily pay off people in order to do fraudulent studies that go out in their favor. But what they do is they reward them when someone in an administrative position, National Institute of Health, Center for Disease Control, when they put out studies that are favorable for the big pharmaceutical industry, they get rewarded with a job at five times the pay that they're making now. And I tell you what government's job is, to make sure that if you're in a regulatory agency, no matter be it the food industry, be it the pharmaceutical industry, you know, you cannot take a job in the private sector for at least 1 year, maybe 2 years. Do you know that you can go walk in the day you leave, you can walk into the pharmaceutical or the food industry? I mean, it's pretty sick.
No, absolutely it is. And you and I have talked about this before, because when it comes down to it, who are the people who actually do the tests on the chemicals that we get, the pharmaceuticals we get? Not the government, the pharmaceutical industry.
That's exactly right. You're absolutely right. You know, and then just to top it off, we've got all these clubs, and one of the clubs is the American Academy of Pediatrics, or I like to call them the American Academy of Pharmaceuticals. Their number one goal is to shoot up our children with all these toxic vaccines. And I'm not taking a position now if we should give vaccines or shouldn't give vaccines, but when you take a look at the ingredients, mercury, aluminum, MSG, neomycin, streptomycin, you know, and then they have the chutzpah. And if anyone doesn't know what chutzpah is, Michael Ray will tell you what chutzpah means, to come out this week and say, toxic environment, how safe are the thousands of chemicals children encounter every day? They're in the toys children play with, on the food they eat, and that the American Academy of Pediatrics says we have to look into this. Vaccines are left out of that list. Come on. No one injects toys into you, you know, but all of a sudden you've got chemicals that are being directly injected into you. Why are all these chemicals in? I for the life of me, I can't figure it out.
Now, by the way, Mayor, I think very strongly, and you've said it, you know, time and again, that the best thing to do is to go down to your local medical doctor, get some blood tests, and check your D3 level. That's
exactly
an easy way to do it. And I'm at that point now where I truly believe with all of the toxins in the air, you know, the deodorants you spray on yourself, the food you eat, whatever the case may be, it has an effect on the balance of the chemicals in your body. And because so, very simple test to go down and get blood test and find out what the levels are. And then if you're low on something, you know how you can amp it up through supplementation, or if you're high, you can do something to bring it down. I think that in and of itself is one of the most preventative steps.
Exactly. And I've always said that, you know, I'm going to be speaking in a couple of weeks at an autism conference, and they said to me, they said, Dr. Eisenstein, can you do something that everyone here can simply benefit from inexpensively? And this is a horrific, horrific problem. And as you know, I've said many times, I believe that this is virtually all caused by childhood vaccines. And I said, yes, if every child in this room, if every mother is going to take vitamin D, you're going to lower your probability of colds, flu, anything you want to look at, for pennies a day. You know, and so my talk is going to be vitamin D, and more vitamin D.
Vitamin D. You know, I was standing here yesterday, and I was looking out the window, and I'm thinking, you know, it's really dark out there. The sun hasn't been out for a while. Without even thinking about it, I went over to it went into the kitchen, and guess what? I got my vitamin D3 out, because if the sun's not going to give it to you, you've got to get it from somewhere.
Exactly. Well, I kept telling my wife that that we don't belong in the Midwest. It's too cold. And boy, it has been. Look, today it was still chilly. I'm sure in Milwaukee it's been chilly also. But when Karen and I sat outside, my wife, this afternoon, even though it was only about 50 degrees, but the sun was out, and it's more than just, there's something radiant about sitting out, something intoxicating about being in the sun, even if you have to be bundled up a little bit, you know.
I totally agree. That's why I make it a point that I go out to get the mail every day. If I'm stuck in the house and I've got an appointment, I'm doing whatever I'm doing, I make sure I get out.
I also want to let all the listeners know that Sunday night at 7 o'clock, Central Time, I'll be doing a complimentary webinar, and I'll be talking about is the end of obesity in sight using our HCG program. And all you have to do to register for the webinar is go to our website, homefirst.com. It's HOMEFIRST.com. Right on the front page toward the bottom, it'll say sign up for the webinar. All you have to do is put your email address in, and you're signed up. You'll get an invitation to the webinar. And I'm pretty excited about this because you can bring your questions, you know, about the program that we have. And you'll also hear from a couple other people who have been very successful in the program. I wanted to let you know, Michael. I know, unfortunately, Michael is a string bean. I mean, he's very muscular, but he's got a problem holding onto weight. I mean, everyone else in this
world. In my face. They kick sand in my face down at the beach. What am I going to do?
We have to date 600 patients, just a little over 600 patients, who've lost in 1 year 12 tons.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're down how much now?
I'm about 110 pounds, and I've been about the same for a while, bouncing around 110 pounds. And I think my body's requiring some time to catch up to all the weight losses, because it's interesting. I looked at a year ago, June, I weighed 244 pounds, and now I weigh 220 pounds. And I have my weights written down every day, but then I went back and looked a year back, and so my wife said, you know something, you want to be about 25 pounds lighter, and you lost about 80 pounds the first year, and 24 pounds the second year. Maybe it's taking one more year to lose the next 24 pounds. And I think she's right about that. What's exciting about this program, I expect it to be, if it worked, 40, 50 pounds a year over a three-year period. But it turns out that you lose about 75% of the weight to an ideal weight in the first year, then about 10 or 12% each year afterwards. And so this is kind of fascinating. But the most exciting thing is, virtually every person who's been with me on this program has not put back any weight. And that's the exciting thing about it. I mean, You know, and I think it's a real unique type of program. If you want to learn more about it, you know, just May 1st, Sunday evening, 7 o'clock, I'll be having a complimentary webinar about it.
Now, you're here, let me give you something disgusting. I have to do this every day or I'm in trouble. That's, the radio Susie just fell off her chair. She loves it when she sees this when I do it. I got a half a bag of steamed potatoes, and then obviously they're going to be, and I put them in a skillet, and I've got virgin olive oil on top of that, and then I season it, and then as soon as it starts to go, and it's in there for usually about an hour because I started on low, and then when that's done, I take a couple of eggs, take some half and half, whip the eggs up, then throw that on top. Then I got to have some meat with that, and once I get the meat with it, whatever it is, then I take cheese and I put it on top of that. And then by the time I got the entire plate full, it takes me a half hour to eat, but I get at least one of those down every day.
And let me tell you something. It takes, you know what the answer is? It takes you a half an hour to eat it, which means you're chewing, you're eating slowly. And that's really important because you gave one of the keys that I've learned, which I knew, but I just, it takes the body about 20 minutes to recognize that you've eaten something.
Yeah.
So if you eat too quickly, what happens is you're still hungry because the body hasn't caught up with realizing that you've eaten already. And I think this is a key and an important point. You know, if I had to leave someone with one little tip of what they could do, chew. My grandmother always used to say, "Mayor, you're eating too fast. Sit down, slow down, just eat slowly." You know, and she understood the value of that, you know, and I think too many of us forget how important it is to chew slowly, eat slowly, you know, and let our bodies enjoy the food and catch up, you know, with what we're eating.
Okay, now I'm going to give you breakfast, but don't throw anything at me, okay?
Okay, I won't throw anything at you.
Oh, good. Okay, it's oatmeal, obviously in water. It's the oatmeal, and then I take two big heaping teaspoons of natural or organic peanut butter, and I throw it in there, and then I get a scoop of wheat germ oil, and that gets thrown in there, and then I put a banana in there and maybe a couple of prunes every once in a while, and then some half and half, and then a couple of pieces of toast with peanut butter and honey on them. So that starts it off with breakfast, and then a couple hours later, it's into that. And I've got the worst time gaining weight. I'm starting to come up now. I'm at probably right at 148, 150 pounds without any clothes on. I want another 15 pounds.
Well, you know what the problem is? You've got a good problem. My guess, how much do you eat between breakfast and lunch?
Oh, nothing.
And what about between lunch and dinner?
Oh, okay, I graze.
When you graze, what do you graze? What do you eat?
Oh, you don't want to
candy
hear.
Bars, ice cream. See, that's it. See, that's the bottom line.
I mean, yeah,
even if you graze, you're going to be eating, my guess is, some nuts, you know, a healthy type of thing, some raisins.
I've got walnuts that I'll graze on, but every once in a while, every couple, 3 days, I will go out and get a pizza loaded with everything you have just to get the calories down.
I'm afraid I can't talk to you anymore.
I
mean, that's. But let me tell you something. 5% of people in the country have your metabolism. 5%, you know, unfortunately, 95% have a different metabolism. But it's not only the metabolism. You said it so well. The chemicals in our food, the GMOs, the genetically modified foods that we have now. All this stuff plays havoc with our system, and really creates a serious problem. You know, and I think that this is one of the things that we have to learn. That my wife has a great saying: if it doesn't rot, you shouldn't eat it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Which means you can't, Twinkies. I'm using it as the classical example. Candy bars. You can leave them in the wrapper and sit in your desk for 5 years, and they'll be just as edible or unedible. You know, it has to rot. Fruits, vegetables, meat, chicken, fish, anything. It has to be able to rot. You don't want to eat it rotten, but it means you have to eat it fresh. And I think that's you know, unfortunately, our whole society has moved away from fresh to non-fresh type food. The minute you process stuff, you know, you're starting to take the nutritional value out of it.
Mayor, there's another side to this also. I am the office, the studio, and everything else is in the basement. So I am up and down those stairs literally 25, 30 times a day. But when I go up and down the stairs, I skip every other stair going up. So, awesome. I mean, I don't sit. I'm not sedentary. And, you know, I'll do what I have to do on the phones, and I spend a lot of time on the phones. But betwixt and between, you know, I'll work out. I'll come up and down the stairs. I will do something that keeps it going. If I ate everything that I told you that I eat, and I do, and if I was sedentary, I'd be 200 pounds right now.
Exactly. And I know that and you also eat well, which means you stay away from as much as possible processed food. And the processed food seems to give you an endless appetite to eat for whatever reason. No one even knows why.
No question about it. And I think what happens, and you said it early on, that you know, you sit down and you eat and you stuff yourself when you eat fast. Your body doesn't know you're full yet, and you don't get it for a half hour or so after you've eaten. So there's those triggering mechanisms. What is that called? Is it ghrelin? What is it that's released to let you know?
Ghrelin, right. Yeah, you got it. You got it. Very good. It's one of the things I'll be talking about Sunday night, you know, leptin and ghrelin. Sounds like two of the
sounds like a Jewish
smurfs.
Couple.
A Jewish couple. No, what were the Gremlins? Wasn't the Gremlins the movie? The Gremlins.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. You know, but you know those are the two hormones. One is the hormone that tells you you're full, and one is the hormone that tells you you're hungry. And it seems that we've distorted our body's ability to recognize hunger and being full. You know, and that's, you know. That's a look, myself too, for many, many years. You know, I have a wonderful story I have to tell you. I had a 21-year-old college student who was about 55 pounds overweight. She's now not an ounce overweight. And I sat with her, congratulating her on the program, how well she's done. And I said, I'm so jealous, I can't even tell you. I wish I knew what you know now, when I was 21 years old. And that's 45 years ago. And, I said, she said to me, would my life have been different? I said, no, I still got blessed to marry the right woman. You know, but yeah, I would have not had to, waste my time or so, or spend so much time trying to figure out how am I going to stay, at a healthy weight, you know, and I'm very proud of the young people because I have very few young people. Most of the people come to me are our age. 40, 50, 60, even 70, you know, which is fine. That's not a problem. But wouldn't this be wonderful if this information gets transmitted down to our young children? Boy, there's a real serious problem with overweight in young adults in their 20s. It's unbelievable.
Major. All right, we're starting to run out of time, and do you think they know that you're not Einstein? Because I always thought you were.
Oh, that's very, very sweet. You know, I mean, I'm from the movie maker family, Sergei Eisenstein. You know, that was
a distant
cousin. You know,
website,
which means we spin tales.
Oh, I love it. Yes, website.
www.homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. And once again, that's the webinar will be this Sunday evening, on everything that I've been doing for the last 2 years.
Wonderful. Mayor Eisenstein, thank you so much. See you next week.
Thank you, my dear friend. Have a wonderful week. Be well. Thank you.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All I have are these arms to enfold.
that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk again on Dresser After Dark. I'm going to ask the board angel floating around there, Seth, do we have our guest?
Yes, we do.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Okay. I got Brian Kaplan with us. Brian Kaplan is the author of Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, Why Being a Great Parent is Less Work and More Fun Than You'd Absolutely Think. Brian's a professor of economics at George Mason University and a blogger at EconLog. One of Wall Street Journal's top 25 economic blogs. His first book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, was named the best political book of the year by the New York Times and made the Financial Times list of the best book of 2007. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. And let us say, Brian, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
But, you know, I love the title, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids. You know, realistically, we live in a society that there are people who have lots of kids and then people who don't. And I wonder if we can really draw the line between the parent who's ready for those children and the parent who's not.
Well, let's see. I'm sure we can. I'm glad you like the title.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Because what's interesting is, you know, most books that try to get people to have more kids basically say, we know that it's a real chore, but do it anyway. Take one for the team. And I don't find appeals like that to be all the persuasive, so I wanted to take a different tack.
Now, okay, now, by the way, the tack, there obviously, is there a way that parents can raise kids where they enjoy them and actually want more?
Oh, yeah. So the heart of the book is all this research that's been done on kids who are adopted and twins. And basically the idea of this research is to really measure how much difference does parenting really make as opposed to heredity. Because, you know, if you got a kid who's adopted and he turns out by one kind of family instead of another, and he turns out one way rather than another, you actually really know that the parenting probably made a difference. And if you look at thousands of kids like that, you can really find out how much of a difference parents are making. And once you know that, you can know what kinds of sacrifices actually pay off and what kinds don't pay off. And the surprising answer is sacrifices in general just don't pay off that much. Kids are really pretty resilient. There's a wide range of different parenting styles that are all about equally good. And the upshot of this is that parents don't have to feel so guilty. There's a lot of different ways you can raise your kids, and they're still going to do fine.
Now, by the way, Brian, if you go all the way back to the 50s, moms were moms, and most of the moms were stay-at-home moms, and there was family. There was no question about that. But what I'm hearing here, and I'm looking at your press release, is what you're saying, and stop me if I'm wrong here, there's a resurgence of moms spending more time with their kids and actually parenting.
Oh, that's right. So actually, as far as we know, I mean, we don't really have numbers going back to the 50s, but in the 60s, moms didn't actually spend that much time taking care of their kids. It was much more common in those days to say, just go outside and play and come back at dinner. It's really more of a modern thing to have parents spending so much time taking care of their kids, shuttling around, and basically having to spend almost every waking minute taking care of them. Actually, in an earlier period, even though people had a lot more kids, the parents had way more time to themselves.
Sure, and in the early to late 50s, one of the reasons for that was you have moms that just went through the Second World War, they just went through Korea, they lost a lot of kids. So they stayed home, they became moms. The 60s came along, it was a different mindset, the peace movement and so on and so forth. There was, I'll think of the word, whatever it was, but there were more reasons for mom not to be at home. And I think that's one of the reasons that they grew apart from it. Now it's starting to come back. I think what we're hearing here is there's a cyclical pattern, time periods when moms stay away and then moms come home again.
I mean, it's possible, but here's the thing. So we've got actual good numbers from like real research going back to the 60s. Before then, we mostly just had stories. Although, I mean, most of the people that I know who grew up in the 30s or 40s and 50s basically say the same thing, that their parents go outside and play, I'll see you at dinner time. And kids were much more responsible for raising themselves in those days. And, it was surprising to us, but they turned out to be normal, functional adults in a way that it's hard to even imagine that a kid today, like when you think of, like, if he doesn't have all this parental pressure, he's just going to turn out to be some kind of a loser or he'll be maladjusted or something. But actually, people grow up, they turn out okay.
Sure, and I think one of the reasons that the kids were a little better grounded in those days, it was safer. You didn't have to worry about if the kid went out that he may not come home again. He could have been shot, could have been whatever. The drugs were not as prevalent in those days. So I truly believe that the window of opportunity for your book is right now, because it's really a way to let moms know and people know that it's okay out there, and family is what causes the model of that child's life for the rest of that child's life. Whatever happens in that family is how that kid's going to turn out.
Well, I mean, actually, you're saying two things that are almost exactly the opposite of what my book says. So, first of all, on the safety, even though we think of the 50s as being a lot safer, it was not. Here we've got really good numbers. Basically, deaths from disease were so much higher in the 50s, and accident rates were actually higher as well. So that even though crime rates were a bit lower back then, the actual risk that a child would die in the 50s is about five times what it is today. Kids today are a lot safer. They're not, really the only difference is that in the 50s, television made everything seem like it was okay when it was not. And now television makes everything seem like it's terrible when it's great.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I would necessarily go say it's great, but at the same time, we look at the different dynamic of living. But it all boils down to the same thing, parenting. And if it's okay, and if you should enjoy having a kid, more kids, then you've got to be able to understand the dynamic of a family unit and how to make it happen. I believe anything, parenting, marriage, relationship, whatever the case may be, going to school, it's all a learned strategy. And if you learn it, and if you've learned it the wrong way, you can always unlearn and you can always relearn again. But you got to have some guidelines to work with.
Right. Well, so in the book, I present a lot of guidelines for how parents can make their lives easier. Because, my main point is parents are needlessly making their lives difficult, and there's a lot of ways that will not hurt kids that parents can use to improve their lives. Like one that I talk about is getting your kid to sleep. I know a lot of parents who lose about 3 years of sleep for every child, because every time the child cries in the crib, they immediately run and pick the kid up. And when kids get picked up, every time they cry a whole lot. But there is a very great and experimentally proven technique for getting kids to sleep through the night once they're 3 months old or so. It's the Ferber technique. And basically it just means that when a kid cries in the crib, you let him cry for 5 or 10 minutes, go in, comfort him briefly, leave. And if he cries again, you let him cry for 5 or 10 minutes more. And if you do this for just a couple of nights, even problem sleepers will start sleeping through the night. So this is one way that you can basically cut down on parent sleep deprivation by a lot. And again, the idea that this is somehow going to mess the kid up, or he's going to feel insecure, or he'll be an unhappy adult. The twin research on happiness shows that there's basically very little long-run effect of parents on how happy of an adult you turn out to be. Identical twins separated at birth are at least as similar in their happiness as identical twins who were raised in the same family and treated the same way.
Okay, so what we're really dealing with, I'm going to go back to learned response. If you understand what it takes as a parent to be able to deal with the kid, be able to deal with the kid in such a way that the kid learns that there's consequence for their actions, there's responsibilities that they have to have, and the most important thing, I would venture to guess, Brian, is that child knows that they're loved at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly, discipline is something else that seems like parents don't do it as much as they did in the past. And clear, consistent, mild discipline does work. There's no need to actually spank or anything like that. I mean, something as simple as the naughty corner actually works even on kids who are poorly behaved. So that makes a big difference. I mean, in terms of love, I think that makes a huge difference for just how happy the child is at the time and how good the relationship is. Right. So it's important for parents to treat their children with kindness and respect. It's not going to turn the person into a happy or a miserable adult. That comes deeper from within, and genes play a big role there. But in terms of the quality of the relationship, you've got a lot of control over that. And I say that's the main thing parents really should focus on, is that's where you really do make a big difference.
Oh, sure. And adoption today, especially, I do not understand why everybody is going outside of the country when there are so many children right here that need a home, that need love, and they need help. But I don't know what it is that causes some of those kids to have to grow up without parents here in homes, whereby going to another country, people adopt, not that it's that easy, but I really don't get it. And that doesn't mean that those kids in those countries shouldn't be adopted and given every chance that they could possibly have. But there's a lack of moms and dads in this country because of the way people look at adoption.
Right. So, you know, I think the main reason people do go to other countries is it's so hard to adopt an infant here, and most people do want an infant. I mean, I think a lot of it is just, you know, basic biology. It's just a lot easier psychologically for people to bond with a new infant.
Sure.
Adopting an older kid, you know, people, you know, it's harder for people to get used to that idea, even though it could make a huge difference in that child's life too. In terms of, like, you know, really changing a life, and what if you really want to totally transform a child's life, adopting a child from a third world country probably is the single best thing you can do. I mean, here I think about Madonna, who adopted a 5-year-old from Malawi. I mean, in Malawi, about 13% of kids die before the age of five. Conditions there are so horrible. I mean, so when you go and pull a kid out of a country like that, you really are giving them a totally new lease on life and changes everything for them. So, you know, it's an incredibly generous act.
By the way, Brian, there's a lot of credibility in that. There's no question, and I would love to see those children help. But I'm going to come back to, and I don't want to get us off focus, but I'm going to come back to, there's so many children right here that need that same kind of help. And maybe they won't die, and they don't have the, they're not subject to the horror that these other kids are subject to, but there's got to be something obviously done for those kids that are somewhere on the outside of our borders. But there's plenty of kids here, and I think that's one of the biggest problems we have in this country right now. Everybody else, we're worried about everybody else, but look what's going on here. And I think adoption is a prime example of that.
Right. I mean, I guess the other interesting thing is that here in this country, when there's an older child in foster care, oftentimes if a foster parent wants to adopt that child and the child wants to be adopted, it still can't legally be done because the parent who actually has totally dropped the ball and is not there for the child still has legal rights that override not only those of the foster parent, but the child himself who wants an actual family that's ready to care for him. So I think that would be, you know, a great thing to do is just to make it legally easier for a kid in foster care to get adopted by a family that really wants him.
Yeah, and because if you're gonna quote unquote dump a kid, okay, which is a horrible even thought, that you shouldn't have any rights, you shouldn't have any legal rights, and that family who wants that child should be able to take over those rights and be able to raise that child in the way that they feel the child should be raised. Let me ask you this: you get into adoption, you get into parenting. I'm going to take you all the way back, and what was it that caused you to look at this issue and put it to pen in the first place?
Right. So it was two things. I mean, so I'd actually been reading a lot about twin research and adoption research for years, but then what really got me thinking was my wife actually got pregnant with twins, and we wound up having two identical twin sons born to us. And once I actually had them, and I actually became a parent, it really got me thinking, wow, I mean, I've read all this research about why kids turn out the way that they do and the kinds of effects that parents have on their kids. And now that I got these twins right in front of me all the time, it just got me thinking, you know, what does this actually mean for parenting? I mean, usually people who, or the, you know, the researchers who study twins, for them it's mostly just an abstract question, like they're trying to find out, you know, like to what extent do genes versus upbringing versus other factors determine how long you live, right? But when I was reading this, I was saying, they find that parents really don't have that much effect on how long kids live, which means that a lot of parental nagging and pushing to improve kids' health doesn't actually work. So those are the kinds of thoughts that I started having.
Okay, so in essence, you really have to be able to take a look at it to be able to think it out before you realize that there are certain problems. Now, have you gotten feedback? How have they been responding to what you've had to say?
Well, there's a wide variety. Actually, the people who like my book the least are the child-free people who just say, look, I just have zero interest in having kids. In the book, I try to be very careful to say, look, all I'm saying is there's an opportunity to raise kids in a more relaxed, less stressful way. If that interests you, great. If it doesn't, that's okay, too. I'm not trying to hassle anyone or push having children anyone. I just want to let people know that if you are interested in having kids, you don't have to lose three years of sleep to do it. There's a lot of other sacrifices that parents impose on themselves that aren't really required or even desirable to do, you know, to do on your kid's behalf. In terms of other reactions, another common one is a lot of parents just say, I just can't believe that I don't have more influence on my kids' adult outcomes than you say. So there's a lot of people say, like, I just can't believe that it, you know, the adoption research or the twin research that it actually would say that I can't boost my kid's intelligence, or at least I don't, right? And the main thing that I say to them is there is a lot of evidence that parents have short-run effects on, say, kid's intelligence or a kid's or a young adult's income, but the punchline is that the long-run effect is a lot smaller than that short-run effect. The way that I describe the results is that, you know, people think about kids as being like a lump of clay that you mold into a certain shape and then put them into the kiln and they stay that way forever. But the science says that kids are a lot more like flexible plastic, where they do respond to pressure, but when you release the pressure, say when they turn 18 and leave your house, they tend to pop back to their original shape.
Brian Kaplan, we're just about out of time. Selfish reasons to have more kids. Is there a website we can find you at?
Sure. www.bkaplan.com is my website, and you can buy the book on amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Brian, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Take care. Good night.
Up the lazy river by the old mill run. Lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun. Linger a while in the shade of the tree. Throw away your troubles, dream a dream of me. You know, before your sister was born, this is what your mama did for a living. Music opened a whole new world to me. No matter how bad I feel, no matter how sad or sick I am, I just touch these keys and poof, like magic. I always hit her. I've always known you had talent, Bobby. This piano is for you. Charlie worked hard for it. See, God wouldn't have made you suffer so much if he wasn't going to make up for it later. How happy you can be up the lazy river with me.
Your troubles, baby, dream a dream with me.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Up a lazy river with me.
Sharky Zartman with us, author of Shark Sense, Getting in Touch with Your Inner Shark. And Sharky is first discovered her inner shark when her volleyball coach told her to quit. And she went on to be a USA national team member and an All-American athlete. She was a member of the first national championship team and was named one of the 25 all-time greats for women's volleyball. She teaches health. She teaches fitness and yoga at El Camino College. And again, her latest book, Shark Sense, Getting in Touch with Your Inner Shark. And let us say, Sharky, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here, Sharky. The title in and of itself is getting in touch with that inner shark. There's too many people that get pushed back in a corner. Somebody says, you can't do it. And guess what? They think they can't, and they don't, and they don't go on to become who they are. Where did yours come from? Where did you get that? They told you no, and no was not one of the options.
Well, I was raised to believe my dad named me Sharky from birth, and he always told me that I could do anything that I really put my mind to and that I wanted to do, and so I always believed that. And when I was young, one of my major goals was to be the best volleyball player that I could possibly be. I visualized myself playing against, you know, Japan and wearing the United States uniform. I would just, you know, I just had that in my head. And so I just kept playing and playing and playing. And when my volleyball coach told me that she thought I should stop playing, it just it activated something inside of me. Instead of quitting, I decided that I wanted it more than ever. And just something came alive inside of me. And I think that's when I really started to connect with this inner source of power, that if somebody tells you you can't do anything, what you want to do, you need to turn that around and find another way. Because if it's important to you, that is important enough to move forward.
You know, there's so many people, Sharky, that have so much influence over people. And usually when somebody says to you, no, you can't, they're really talking about themselves. And most people don't get that because they can't do it. They're not going to admit it. So obviously it's not them. It's you can't do it. And there's too many people that buy into that.
Yes, and I think it's tragic. I see a lot of young people, again, at the college. I have over 300 students this semester, and a lot of them are there doing things not because of what they want to do. It's like they're expected to, you know, achieve certain goals or go into certain careers or go to particular schools. And my question always to them is, what do you want to do? And sometimes it's hard for them to answer because they haven't really thought that much about it. And when they really start thinking about it, sometimes it puts them in another direction, which I think is very healthy.
Okay, let's say I want to get my sharkness out here. And being
okay.
The shy, inverted person that I have always been, how can we unveil that? You've got questions that you could ask. So I'm going to open it up and I'm going to be the person to answer the questions. Let's find out if I can unveil my inner shark.
Okay. First thing, where are you now? And is it where you want to be right now?
Well, the answer to that is yes.
Okay.
I'm doing what I'm doing and it's where I want to be.
Is there anything that you would like to be doing in the near future that you're not doing now?
Not really. It's the same thing, but just a little bit of a offshoot of it. Actually, no. I love what I do.
Okay. Is there somebody that you'd like to be an example for to help them out to move forward towards their goal?
Tons of people.
Okay. Well, there we go then. And so you can be an empowerment example for them and allow them to see their potential and their talent in terms of moving towards what they want to be. Because sometimes if we're content and we're happy, that doesn't mean that we still can't help other people move towards their goals. And so because there's so many people out there that need the support, that need the help, that need the direction, that are not getting it.
Now, by the way, and being a shark means that you have that inner strength to go out and get what you want to get. Once you hit in that one direction, you're going to move and there's nothing that's going to get in your way. And I really believe that shark is about the best way to really give an example. Now, you talk about some of the sharks in the media, some of the ones that we respect. Who are we talking about that comes to your mind very quickly?
Very quickly, I think two people that come to mind the quickest are Ellen DeGeneres, because she has always been true to herself and just hasn't taken to heart any of the criticism she's gotten for being who she is. I mean, she dances in the aisles of her studio audience. I mean, she is unique, and she just accepts herself.
She came out of the closet, and she said, this
exactly.
is who I am. And there's my strength, and we're going to move with it. Okay.
Right. And another person that comes to mind is Sylvester Stallone. He, he originated the Rocky series, which basically you get knocked down and you don't stay down. You just keep coming back for more. And I think also I read a couple things about his life in terms of people criticizing him for still coming out and making these movies, and he goes, why not? It's what I do. It's what I'm good at. And the critics are always silenced because his movies always do really well.
Absolutely, so. Everybody's there. They want to see it. They want to watch him because
exactly.
you and you said it all. And the strength behind Stallone is you're going to get knocked down, but the real strength is you get up and you keep moving forward.
Exactly. And too many people just whine and moan when they get knocked down. They just they quit too soon. A lot of times they quit right before they get what they're going after. And life isn't supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be about the struggle. It's supposed to be triumph and also hard times. That's what we're here for, right?
But Sharky, the hard times are the learning process.
Exactly.
And when you get knocked down, but you learn from something that whatever it was that caused you to fall down, that's the learning process. Now, if you see it and you get up and you move forward, that's one thing. But if you don't see it, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get knocked down for the same thing again and again and again until you see it. And then once you see it and you get up and you move, you know what the big prize is? You get something else to knock you down so you can learn something more.
Well, you never arrive. I mean, people are always moving forward. You never know it all. You should always be trying to move towards something to help people. I hear a lot of times people that want to retire because they're just sick of their work and stuff, and then they retire, and all of a sudden, you know, they don't help anybody. They don't do anything, and that's when they get old and decrepit. I mean, as long as you're learning and moving forward and not staying stuck in the past, you're living.
They get old and they get decrepit for one reason, because they've lost their sense of identity. They've lost their sense of being. Too many people get stuck in that job or that profession, whatever it is, and they're not them anymore. They're that profession. And when that's gone, they have nothing to anchor to, nothing to fall back on. And I think that's really what the problem is. What I'm hearing with the shark is you're going to find not the shark, but you're going to find the inner you. And the inner you stays there no matter where you are geographically, where you are monetarily, where you are emotionally, whatever the case may be. It's that one constant that you have to keep strong, because that inside glow is the thing that's going to cause you to move forward or get locked in a closet somewhere.
Right. And I see so many of the young people that I work with now that are so, especially women, I think could really benefit from, you know, the empowerment model with the shark, because they are so influenced by the media and some of the false images that are out there. And it makes them feel really bad about themselves, like they're not good enough. And it's just, it's tragic that, you know, we have that going on.
You mean everybody doesn't look like Lady Gaga?
I don't think so. Plus, with all the retouching that's out there, some of these images that are out there, I heard one doctor say, that's such a false image, her organs wouldn't even fit in that body. And that's what some of these people are seeing, things outside of themselves that are unreal, and they're not feeling empowered. And so really we have to move more inside and discover our inner strengths and discover what we really want to do, and then ignite the passion and just put it in motion, keep it moving forward and adapting where we need to adapt, being flexible where we need to be flexible. I mean, just, you know, we can't get stagnant.
No, and I think what a lot of people don't get, and it's very strong, you could have somebody who, let's say, is overweight. Maybe she's a little sloppy about the way she dresses and so on and so forth, and you can stand her up next to Lady Gaga, and there are men that would turn to her as opposed to Gaga. So we are all very gorgeous in the eyes of the beholder, and that you can't change. So you be the best you can be, and if somebody doesn't like you, they're not going to like you no matter what you do. And if somebody does like you, they're going to like you for who you are. And it's not what you look like. It's what they see that you look like.
Exactly. And I wish that more people knew that and were able to experience that for themselves. But a lot of times they just don't put themselves in the situations where they get that kind of an exchange. They're always looking outside of themselves with their friends, and it just kind of multiplies among some of these young people. And I worked in an eating disorder center this last summer, yeah, teaching yoga, and it's just so sad that a lot of these people, women mostly, are very, very sick as a result of it. So,
oh, sure. No question about it. But the key is buying into somebody else telling you that you're not good enough, you're not worth it, you're not, you know, I mean, the list goes on. I'm sure you've seen it time and again. And that we are good enough, and we are attractive, and we are all of those things. And that's not just saying we're going out into the world and we're living this dream that we're gorgeous even if we're not. Yes, you are. And I would emphasize that no matter what happens. Somebody is going to see you in a way that you don't even see yourself. And if you don't let them see you being gorgeous, quote unquote, you're going to turn them away and you're going to miss that opportunity.
I totally agree.
Yeah, no, I agree. And women are coming into their own, have been for quite a number of years now. And, you know, there's been this movement and that movement. But when it really comes down to it, it has to do with how you, quote unquote, feel inside the shark. Because you can get in any kind of a group you want, but then when you don't have the strength of the group and you're out there on your own and you haven't built that strength inside of you, you're going to fall apart.
Right. And the self-empowerment, when you feel good about yourself, when you are connected with a passion and a purpose, you can do anything. Your self-esteem just resonates. And people see you for who you are. They don't see, you know, the exterior. They see the interior. And that's really what this whole thing is about that I'm trying to get out there with using the shark as a metaphor. Because, you know, we sometimes have to simplify in order to be powerful. I mean, instead of all the hard things we think we have to do, we already have what we need inside of us to be powerful and to be successful in life.
And the biggest thing we have to get over is, if I repeat this a million times till the day I'm not here anymore, is to get over what somebody else thinks about you. Because at your best, at your optimum, Sharky, you can only be the second best me. And reverse that. If I tried my best to be you, I can only be the second best you. So what does this mean? I got to go be the first best me that I can be, because I'll never be perfect by being you, because you're the one who's got the perfection. But you can't be perfect being me, because I'm the one who's got that. And I think that's really the key. Stop living by other people's definition of what you should be.
Exactly. In fact, you sound a lot like my husband. He's a psychology teacher. In fact, I was going to tell you at the start, when I went and found the other coach, my high school coach told me I shouldn't play, he was the coach that I found, and 8 years later I married him.
Well, that's great.
Isn't that funny?
I think it's great. Okay. So actually, the one who said no to you was responsible for you falling in love and being in the relationship that you're in today.
That's she did me a great favor, because if she hadn't done that, my life would not have taken off in this direction. I never would have made the national team or UCLA, gotten to play professionally and coach at a high level, and have two beautiful kids that, you know, my husband and I have been married for over 30 years, and none of that would have happened.
See, but when you come down to it, so we owe her, don't we?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, we do. And I certainly don't resent her for, I don't think she was being mean to me. I think she just didn't think I had what it took to be,
Sharky,
you know,
she did the best thing that could have ever happened to you. Because you can only write about who you are. And what happened was the shark came up. And because of the shark, you wrote the book, and the rest of it is called Recognizing It. You know, you're a typical example of Stallone. Stallone, you know, you get knocked down, you get back up, and you keep moving. Well, the person who knocked you down is the one that you have to say thank you to.
That's absolutely correct. And sometimes the people in our lives that we have the most problems with, or who hurt us, are the ones that we benefit the most from, because they're the ones that bring out our inner source of power.
Absolutely. And thank goodness that people like yourself write books, because then somebody will read it and then they will recognize it. If you don't recognize it, it can get thrown in your face, I don't know how many times, and it just doesn't mean anything. All right, let me ask you this. When you wrote the book, and this happens to all authors, it doesn't matter whether it's fact, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, there was that aha moment time, that epiphany, when in the middle of writing the book, you began to realize a dimension of the subject matter that you didn't know was there. Where was that for you?
I think when I really started to tell stories, because originally I was in an author group that was, it was a storytelling group, and I didn't want to just tell stories. I wanted to make them, you know, give life lessons. And so I started relating the life stories to lessons that you could learn from it. And then I started to realize, well, this is all related to a shark because, yeah. I mean, I've always been associated with that. And so that was kind of the aha. And then I started to research sharks and take the positive survival attributes that they have, not the negative ones, the positive ones, and go, hey, this is an aha moment, because all of these life principles that you see in just about every book on, you know, success tools or life principles or anything, it's the same things. I'm just using the shark to kind of give it a little spin, a little twist, and just to make it a little bit more profound.
Now, by the way, that coach had to be this happened to you, 30 some odd years ago?
Uh huh.
Well, is the coach still alive?
I don't know.
We should help
I
her.
Haven't
we should
really
find
checked.
Out. We should, you should send her flowers.
Maybe I will check into that, Michael. That's a good idea.
You're wonderful. Okay. But that releases you right now. You hear it? If there's anything even deep down that you're holding, send her flowers. That'll cut it off right away.
Okay.
All right. Now, we're about running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. Just sharkeyzartman.com, sharkeyzartman.com. And there's a link to the book Shark Sense.
Wonderful. And by the way, we're going to check up on you to make sure you sent the flowers.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Hey, Sharky Zartman, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Then there's nothing in the world can hurt us long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm.
Hey, I'm Michael Ray Dresser. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening closely, tell your friends to listen closely also. That's the way we grow. That's what you call networking. And I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Long as we're singing out. Long as we're singing out.